Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to local MP Daisy Cooper to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get answers from Daisy this time, she will be back again next month in December to be chatting to you just before Christmas. But since we last talked to you, Daisy, it's been a very busy period, but we've also seen the country go into a second lockdown. So in terms of work and life in general, how has the second lockdown been for you?
Well, I guess the second lockdown hasn't made a huge difference to me in some ways, because I was already doing the mixture of working from home and going into Parliament, you know, when I want to take part in debates and speak in urgent questions. And I'm still doing both of those two things. Obviously, just like everybody else, there's no socialising anymore. So that's changed. But in terms of how I do my day job, it hasn't really changed that much.
During that time as well, it was your birthday. Were you able to fit in some positive celebrations at all?
Oh, I had the evening off on my birthday, and my husband made a really tasty cock of lamb, which we had, and we had some very nice raspberry daiquiris that we knocked up in the kitchen. But I decided that it was probably just easier staying in. As you probably know, I'm quite cautious, and I think for as long as we're living with coronavirus, we all have to behave as though we have it, even if we don't. And so I just, you know, I was very conscious that we were sort of probably heading at that stage towards a second lockdown. So I decided to stay at home, enjoy some of my husband's cooking and have a couple of cocktails and then an early night.
Sounds like a really kind of wholesome evening. Now, obviously, you've described that your birthday had tempered celebrations because of the coronavirus lockdown. But there are two or three vaccines on the horizon, Daisy, and this could be something to be cause for celebration. We might see a return to normality maybe sometime in 2021. But there is a problem facing the country as a whole, and Labour have highlighted this, calling for a stop to anti-vaccination fake news online, a law to almost ban this. Is this something that you would back?
Well, I definitely agree with the sentiment behind it, because we have got to tackle fake news, and the big social media companies have completely failed to do that. And so we do need to do something. I think the question is how we do it. Now, obviously, Labour have called for a law. They haven't sort of spelled out in detail what that law would do or how it would work, but they've sort of suggested that you might put big penalties on the big social media companies if they didn't take certain things down. I think my concern from a free speech point of view is that you might then end up in a situation where in some cases you're taking things down that might be legitimate concerns or criticisms, and also where you do have things that are genuinely fake news, you then sort of drive those conversations off those sites and drive them underground onto a different site somewhere else. So the question of how you do it is really, really important. Now, I've actually been looking at this issue probably for about 2 years now, you know, from even before I was elected. And one of the things that I would like to see, and Liberal Democrats have this as part of their party policy now, is a new system of regulation for the big social media companies. Now, what that would mean is that you would, for example, have fines on social media companies, but there'd be lots of other things they have to do first. So, for example, I think big social media companies should be changing their algorithms. So when something is fake news, it is deprioritized, and they don't start churning it out and promoting it to all sorts of people. Also, I think it's really important that when something is reported and certified as being fake news, there needs to be a flag on it so it's transparent to people. And we saw Twitter doing this with Donald Trump's tweets during the recent presidential election in America. It's rather than banning things, a liberal approach would be to have more transparency. And so what I would like to see is the labelling of fake news as questionable and as fake news, with links to fact checkers and things like that. And I think, say, more transparency, better labelling, and then changing the algorithm so that that dangerous fake news is not promoted even more. It's actually downgraded in terms of the profile that it gets. So I think, as I say, I'm very, very sympathetic to tackling this idea. I think the devil's always in the detail. And so rather than heavy-handed laws that might actually then backfire, a system of regulation might be a better way ahead.
And with this kind of regulation of the social medias, would it be an independent body from the government, you know, to certify what fake news is? Because the social media companies might have their own political leanings. Facebook recently were kind of exposed that one of their independent groups were actually a far right group, some indiscriminate companies. So what do you think would be the process for actually monitoring this as well? Would it be government led, or would it be down to the social media companies to do it themselves?
So there's a system that we are in favour of, which is either called independent self-regulation or co-regulation. And basically what that means is that the social media companies are very different in terms of how they operate. You know, people experience that as a user. So you know that Twitter operates in a very different way to the way that Instagram works and the way in which Facebook works, right? So you couldn't, I don't think it's possible to have one regulator to regulate all of them, because they wouldn't then understand the different ways in which the algorithms work and the different way that people use them. So I think that each of these platforms needs to develop its own regulator. So they have their own regulator that understands how that particular platform works, but that regulator then needs to meet certain criteria that is set by an arm's length body, and that arm's length body would probably be set up through a governmental process, so not directly by government. And it sounds quite complicated, that's because regulation is quite complicated. But you'd have an independent body that would then check that self-regulator met various criteria, that it was independent, that it wasn't politically affiliated, and that it provided a quick and fair form of redress for people who wanted to make complaints, and that the regulator that had been set up was sufficiently independent from the actual organisation it was regulating. So there's lots of different criteria you can have to make sure that it is in fact independent. And actually, this form of regulation that I'm suggesting is exactly the same form of regulation that was proposed by Lord Leveson for the operation of the major national newspapers. And that is a way where they should continue to regulate themselves, but the regulator they set up must reach certain criteria around whether it's independent from the newspapers that it's regulating, and whether it's effective for the readers. And you could have that same form of regulation across newspapers and social media platforms. And increasingly, I think it's really important that we do have the same system, because it's really, really bizarre that you can have a newspaper that says something in print and there's one form of regulation for that, and then they say something on a social media platform and there's a completely different form. Well, at the moment, there's no real regulation for either of them, but there are different, you know, you'd have different regulatory frameworks. Quite frankly, we need a regulatory framework that makes sure that if you say something and do something that is fake news, it doesn't matter what platform it is on, it should be treated on its own merits. And that's why I think this new kind of system that could operate across all forms of media would be the best form to adopt.
Now, kind of linked to social media, I tweeted out, and no fake news here from me, but a YouGov poll stated 44% of the people want proportional representation in this country, whereas only 28% would continue first past the post. In the 2019 election, this would have meant Conservatives actually lost 77 seats, Labour would have had 14 seats, and the Liberal Democrats would have had more, so 59 more seats. This is also something that Liberal Democrats have talked about before with AV, so the alternate vote, which is different from proportional representation. Some commentators have said that the most likely way of getting electoral reform, whether you think it's fair or not, we can discuss, but is the only way to get this would be for Labour and Lib Dems to unite on this issue. Is this something that you're going to investigate? Is this a deal that might be done between the two parties?
Goodness, well, I mean, that question packs there's quite a lot in that question, so let's unpack some of it. I mean, the first thing is I can only speak for the Lib Dems, I can't speak for the Labour Party. But in terms of speaking for the Lib Dems, you know, we have believed in proportional representation as a better form of government for a long time. And, it's because we believe in every single vote, carrying weight. Every single vote should matter. And I think it's hugely frustrating to people around the country, including here in St Albans, that when it comes to election time, you get politicians like me going around saying, please vote for me because, you know, voting for me is the only way to get rid of that person, or vote for me because that's the only way that you can get rid of this, you know, this party or what have you. And the fact is that first past the post means that there's only really two people and two parties that can win in any particular area. And if neither of those are your first choice, then you have to choose tactically as to which one is the least bad of two evils, as it were. And that's why, you know, politicians like me are sort of not forced to, but that's why we end up having to go around making those arguments. And I think proportional representation would be better for a lot of reasons. One, because every single vote would actually matter, and actually I think it would bring about broader improvements to our politics as well. So for example, when it came to election time, rather than me saying, don't vote for that person because they can't win, vote for me instead. Instead, what I'd be saying is, well, vote with your heart for whoever you want to vote for, but please give your second preference to me. And I'd be explaining why what I believe in is similar to what they want to hear, as opposed to why it's the complete opposite. So it would end up being a more consensual form of politics, where politicians are trying to find things they've got in common rather than things that they can have a go at each other about. So that's why I believe in it, and that's why the Lib Dems do believe in it. And from a personal point of view, this is not party policy yet, but yes, I think that we should have it as a red line for any future deal that we might consider. That said, we're a long way off from the next general election. I've got no idea what state the Labour Party or any other party is going to be in then. But I do think that there is a groundswell of support for PR. And just this week, we've seen in Wales that the Welsh government has given the right to local councils in Wales to move to a form of PR rather than first past the post if they want to. So we could see local councils in Wales, gradually adopting a form of PR. And I think it's really important at local level as well that we have it, not just at a national level. So I think there is a groundswell of support. These things often change when you least expect them. So it could be because there's a future deal at some point in the future. It could be because there's a groundswell of support from a different angle. It's always slightly alarming to point this out, but Nigel Farage is a huge supporter of PR. It's because, he's from has been a member of various small parties haven't been able to get their voice heard in Parliament. And even though I disagree with pretty much the values and views of everything that Nigel Farage says, the fact is that I do think it's important for our democracy that small parties are heard in Parliament, and that the people who vote for those small parties have their views represented. So I'm in favour of it. Lib Dems are in favour of it. We're long-term supporters. I can't say how or when that it might change, or whether it will change. But certainly, if we were entertaining any future deal, I would like to see it as a red line.
Now, you've mentioned Wales there, and that segues nicely into my next question, because during this lockdown period, we've seen a very unsavoury event where period products were not classed as an essential item for shopping in the area. Has legislation been put in place to stop this from happening again?
So it wasn't so much an issue with legislation, but it was an issue with guidance that the government had issued as a result. My understanding is that guidance, I think, was changed quite quickly as soon as that happened. So obviously one of the major supermarkets was criticised for this. And I think the Welsh government did reissue some guidance pretty quickly, I think in a matter of days, to clarify that actually period products were very clearly an essential item. But it does point towards a broader frustration, which I'm very acutely aware of around the country, including here in St Albans, which is that, the government hasn't very clearly articulated what is essential and what isn't essential. And I think that's caused a degree of resentment, because what we've seen, in St Albans and around the country, is that some of the big retailers have remained open and they're selling not only what you might consider to be essential items, whether that's, period products or shampoo and clothes, but they're also selling some non-essential items. And that's hugely frustrating, of course, to independent retailers, who may not be able to. So for example, if you are a really big supermarket, it might be that you're still selling birthday cards and Christmas cards and wrapping paper. Whereas if you are an independent shop that only sells cards and wrapping paper, then obviously you can't open. So it does point to a broader problem about how you define these things and how you deal with it. There are no easy answers on this, but I think what we do need to see from the government is certainly a plan to support our independent retailers, who have clearly suffered the brunt of this second lockdown, when some of the big retailers have actually managed to keep open and they have been selling what I think many of us would regard as non-essential items during that period of time.
Another problem that you've expressed during this lockdown, and you wrote about this in the Daily Express, is for the need of the government to find a way to make visits possible to those in care situations. A lot of doctors have talked about the negative impact that this isolation has been on elderly and vulnerable people. You know, they're feeling lonely, and this does affect mental and physical health. So what progress has been made in Parliament on this issue?
Yeah, well, as you say, it's a hugely sensitive subject, and there was a debate in Parliament around this, and it's the separation of family carers from people in care homes that we'd go and care for. And there's a number of people in St Albans who had contacted me about this, and their stories are sort of really heartbreaking. And in the debate we had in Parliament, some of the examples that other MPs gave were actually really harrowing. And I mean, I won't go into too many details, but there was, you know, one case that I think all of us were quite shocked and upset to hear, of a very young person who is in a care home and whose mother wasn't able to see him during the first lockdown at all. And nobody else in the care home, because they were just busy looking after their residents, noticed that he had stopped eating, and effectively he wasted away and ended up dying. It's just horrific that has been happening. And even where people haven't got to that stage, you know, for people who are maybe in a care home and they're maybe at end of life, or maybe they're living with dementia, it can be incredibly confusing for them to not understand why they can't touch their loved ones, why they have to talk through windows. And so this is something that has to get sorted and sorted quickly. So when we had the debate, what the government said was that they're going to do a trial period, and the trial period will allow some family carers to visit care homes, and during the trial period they will be given what I and many other MPs have been calling for, which is to give them the same status as key workers. So if you are a carer who has key worker status, you're entitled to regular testing, you're entitled to PPE, you're entitled to having access to the care home. But of course family carers often do, you know, just as much if not more caring than these professional paid carers. So we're calling for family carers to have those rights as well. My big concern is that the government is not moving on this fast enough. So they said they'll do this trial period before Christmas, but they haven't committed to a timeline about how fast they can roll it out. Now, a couple of big national newspapers got behind this campaign, and as a result, Matt Hancock, the Secretary of State, has said that, you know, people will be able to hold the hands of their loved ones at Christmas. So he's made a very bold promise in that regard. But at the moment, I personally can't see what the timeline is that leads up to everybody being able to do that, because they're taking so long in getting the trial study done. What I would like to see is for them to have the same ambition that they had for building the Nightingale Hospital and talking about moonshot programmes as well. They should have that level of ambition for making sure that families can see their loved ones at Christmas.
Now, we've got to move it on to the discussions that the community want here, because here at Radio Verulam, we're all about the community questions, answering what is bothering them. So let's move on to what the area want to know. And Anna, I think, has asked an important question here about schools. She says, you have backed the cancelling of exams in Wales. Are you working on making similar arrangements for English pupils too? As a mum, this is stressful. So when will there be updates and certainties?
Yeah, I really, really feel for Anna and her children. So the situation we have is that in both in Scotland and in Wales, they've decided to cancel GCSE and A-level exams. And the fundamental reason for doing that is because there's been huge variety in terms of the amount of schooling that children have been able to have around the country. So, you know, in some parts of the country, they've mostly been in school, but maybe been out for a few days. In other parts of the country, they've been out of school for months and months and months, and they've only had a few days this whole term actually in the classroom. Some children will have access to a digital device at home, like a laptop or a tablet, but other children won't have had access to that. Some children will only have had an iPhone to work off at home, and that means that there isn't a level playing field in terms of how much teaching they have had and on what subjects and the medium through which they've been able to learn. And because of that, it's just simply not fair on children across the country to have a national exam. The whole point about a national exam is that it has to be conducted under national standards, where everyone's had the same kind of national level of access to teaching, and that just hasn't been the case. So what's really important from my point of view is that this doesn't descend into an argument about whether exams are intrinsically good or bad. You know, we can have that argument, that's a separate argument. I think what this argument is about this year is whether or not an exam, a national exam, can be run and administered in a way that is fair to students across the country. In Scotland and Wales, they've decided that it can't be done in a way that is fair. I believe that's the same case in England as well. I've written to the government, I've written to the Secretary of State for Education and said to him that it's very firmly my view that this now can't be run in a fair way for students, and that's the primary argument for cancelling these exams. The second argument is that teachers are now saying that it's almost impossible to actually teach all of the content that they would need to be able to teach in order to actually conduct these exams next year. So there are some people calling for the government to provide guidance on dropping some of the modules. Some organisations are calling for guidance from government about how many modules should even be assessed through exams. Some are calling for greater teacher-moderated assessments throughout the year. Whatever the government does, it needs to do it quickly, and it needs to make a very quick decision for a few reasons. The lack of certainty at the moment is causing unbelievable amounts of stress for pupils, for parents and guardians, and for teachers. And teachers also are going to have to decide how to spend their budgets over the next 4 or 5 months. Should they be spending their money on increased teachers to improve learning, or should they be spending their money on exam intervention teachers that simply prepare people for sitting exams? You know, we need to have some certainty. We should have had it weeks, if not months ago. The government is still failing to provide that. So whatever the government decides, it needs to do it soon. And my view is that I think the exam should be cancelled, and I'll continue to put pressure on the government to see if we can get to that position.
And Ian has, I think it's a linked subject here, has highlighted a problem with actually how this important news is getting out. He's asked the question, why are we getting a lot of important news about lockdown or rule changes from select newspapers? Is it leaks, or is this a new government policy?
So it is very, very worrying. It is worrying. And the Speaker of the House in Parliament, who is basically he's like the referee, right? He's like the referee in a football match or an adjudicator. He's the one who sort of tells off different political parties for the way that they behave or don't behave. And he himself has pointed out that, you know, the House of Commons is supposed to be sovereign. It's supposed to be where announcements are made. And it's hugely frustrating, I think, both to the public, but also to MPs like me, that we hear announcements in select newspapers and not in the chamber where they should be announced first. And sometimes even when there are national announcements, they're done in a press briefing to journalists rather than in the House of Commons. And that's frustrating for a few reasons. I mean, one, you know, as MPs, we hear people's concerns very quickly. As soon as people are concerned about something, they email us. You know, we probably hear about stories faster than journalists in some cases. And therefore, it's only right as people's representatives that we should be able to quiz the government when they make announcements. And so when they announce them, or they kind of leak them, as we think is happening, obviously we don't know for sure, but that's certainly the impression we get, is that there are select briefings. It means sometimes the information is not correct. Sometimes it's written in a way that's very alarming and will scare some people, which is not helpful. There'll be a particular spin and political take on it. So it is very frustrating, and I understand everyone's concerns about it. All I can say is that we've made various complaints in Parliament about this. The Speaker has introduced a lot of sessions for MPs to quiz the government, particularly on health matters and the handling of the pandemic, on the basis that because a number of these announcements were being made outside Parliament, we're now being given extra time to sort of quiz ministers inside Parliament. But all I can say is it's frustrating. I wish the government didn't do it, and we'll do our best to keep quizzing them.
We're moving the topic of conversation here, actually. We've had quite a few questions about how the Lib Dems work towards electoral success. So the first one here is from Joe, and she says, well, I assume that it's a she. They say, what's the Lib Dem strategy for regaining former heartland seats in South West England and coastal Scotland?
Good question. I mean, that's probably not, so I'm not going to divulge all of our tactics on a public radio station, I'm afraid. If Joe is interested, he or she, I don't know whether it's J-O or J-O-E, but if Joe is interested in having that conversation, I suggest you join the Lib Dems and it comes to a private briefing on that. But, you know, I think what we've said publicly is that we are, as a party, Liberal Democrats are in second place to the Conservatives In 80 seats around the country. We are determined to do what we can to win as many of those as possible. I am now not just the MP for St Albans, but also deputy leader of the party. We obviously had some success in winning St Albans last year, and I will be taking many of the lessons that we've learned here to other parts of the country to try and win back those heartlands. But I'm not going to be divulging our tactics, I'm afraid, on Radio Verulam today.
I mean, continuing the football metaphors, you know, that would be allowing the first 11 to be shown weeks before. You know, I totally get what you're saying there. But Louise has asked another question, and maybe you might be able to answer this one a little bit better. Maybe you won't be displaying all your tactics and showing your card and hands on the table. But they've asked, how can the Lib Dems improve messaging on social media to target a younger generation and get them active?
Sure. Well, there's a few things I would say. And the first thing I would say about young people is that a lot of young people are interested in politics, right? But they're interested in particular issues, I think. So anything that politicians and political activists do has to be relevant to young people for them to get engaged. And when I go into schools and go into sixth form colleges, the questions that they want to raise with me are things around, you know, the climate crisis and around their exams. And they want to hear messaging that relates to them and their lives. But a lot of young people, I think, have been mobilised over the last few years and do get involved. But it's also, I mean, there's two other things I would say. I think young people these days have incredibly tough lives. You know, there's a huge amount they have to do in terms of, you know, there's huge amounts of stress in their schooling because of the way that our education system is now designed. They have the additional pressure of social media, the long-term prospects of, you know, having to work incredibly hard, the extra competition in the workplace, in the employment field. Obviously, we're going into a recession. House prices are through the roof in many parts around the UK. It's very difficult for a young person. And therefore, I think in terms of expecting young people to be able to carve out time for politics, we have to be realistic about all the other pressures they're facing in their lives. But I guess the other point I would make is that many of them are already involved, but they choose to get involved perhaps in groups that are political groups, but not necessarily political parties. And so there's lots of them involved in, you know, climate rallies and anti-plastic rallies and whatever else it might be, in getting involved in homelessness campaigns. I know that in St Albans where there's a sleeping out event where people won't be sleeping out on the street to raise money for homelessness, but they'll be doing it in their own homes or possibly sleeping on their sofa. And so I think young people are already involved in politics. How we improve our messaging is to make sure that it's relevant to their lives and the issues that they're interested in, the same as it is for anybody of any age.
Do you think as well that there might be an apathy towards political parties? So like you said, their movements are maybe a little bit more popular, but the apathy is towards actual kind of structured parties, whether it be Lib Dem, Labour or Conservative, due to the overlooking by governments over the years of this generation of young people in whatever era it has been?
So I think the fact is that a lot of people don't really get involved in political parties until they have to engage with services. So there's sort of two groups of people, there's sort of two age brackets when people really get motivated by party politics. One is in their sort of late 20s, early 30s, when often they become either they might develop a health issue or they might become parents and they've got children and all of a sudden they have to go to the GP quite a lot and they suddenly notice that they can't park outside their GP and they have to start planning for childcare and nursery places. And at that kind of age, that's when people suddenly realise that they care about things like who makes decisions about funding for, you know, for GP services and for the NHS and who sorts out the parking and all those kind of issues. So that's kind of one age bracket when people tend to get motivated. And the other is when people retire because they have time on their hands. And so when people retire, they think, oh, well, I've done this, I've done that, I've done this with my career. Now I've got a bit of spare time, I'd like to give back and get involved and try and make my community better. So those are sort of two sort of age brackets when people tend to get involved in party politics. And when you think about their kind of motivations, you can understand why it is that young people are less likely to get involved in party politics because they're very, very mobile. They often move around the country a lot. They're often not living in the same place for any particular long period of time. They may not have a very close contact with some of the local services, so they have less reason to be interested in how those decisions are made. made. So I don't think that it's necessarily apathy. I don't see any apathy amongst young people at all. I see young people being absolutely fired up and chomping at the bit, wanting to change the world. The question is how you change the world. And it's not often until later in life that they see political parties as a vehicle for doing that.
So continuing this discussion about the Lib Dems here, and Anonymous has actually asked the question here, will the Lib Dem party adopt a strong anti-racist policy platform similar to that of the Green Party?
Well, we have already. At our last conference, which was a virtual conference, we adopted a motion which was called, I think it was called racial inequality. Let me try and get this right. I think it was Tackling Racial Inequality Can't Wait, or something like that. I can't remember the titles of any of the other motions either, but it was a really strong motion that was put together by the Liberal Democrat Campaign for Racial Equality and other people in the party. And anybody who wants to see that, I can certainly direct them towards that motion. But it was a very strong motion. I think it had a lot of really good content in it. We have shown our support for the Black Lives Matter movement. Of course, you know, every political party is a subset of the country and will have its issues. We've seen that with the Labour Party, you know, with anti-Semitism, and the Conservative Party with Islamophobia issues as well. So, you know, every political party has to make sure that it doesn't take these things for granted and double down and oppose all forms of racism.
Oliver has actually asked, who does Daisy believe the Lib Dem vote base should be? So which kind of voters are you appealing to?
Sure, okay. Well, I think it's a very interesting question. So the fact is, for as long as we have first past the post, we have to bring together coalitions of voters, right? That's how we have to win seats, in whether that's at a local council level or whether that's at a national level. And first past the post forces us to do that. And so there'll be some people who I'd say share our political values, which means that they might, for example, they might be pro-internationalist, they might be pro-environmentalist, they might be pro-small business, and they're sort of what you might call natural liberals. And so there are certainly some people in that group who we would want to vote for us because they sort of share our natural political ideology. But then there'll be other people who vote for us for different reasons. And this has always been the case. Some people will vote for us because we believe in localism, and an extension of the fact that we believe in localism and devolution is that we work really hard at winning power at a local level. We believe that local government is really, really important. And because of that, often around the country, what you find is that people say that the Liberal Democrats are the only people who knock on their door, they're the only people they see throughout the year, they're the only people that they hear from. And that really matters as well, because that's a different value. That's a value of having local connection and being a community champion. That's something else that we believe in. So people might vote for us on that basis alone, because they know that we work hard and we're in their area and that we believe in making decisions as close to those people as possible. So I think in any election, particularly whilst we have first past the post, it is around building a coalition of different voters and putting people together from different voter bases.
Now, Tony has actually highlighted that there is an election coming up, but on a local level. They've asked, elections are not that far away. How does Daisy think that the Lib Dems should campaign, given that, as you mentioned there, this kind of door-knocking, friendly approach, knowing that the local neighbourhood might not be able to be done in 2021 with COVID not sorted out yet? That this isn't very COVID-friendly approach, Tony has pointed out.
Well, we are renowned for our door knocking, and that's because we genuinely believe in listening to what people have to say and trying to represent them as best we can. But you're right. I mean, it's very difficult to go out and knock on doors at the moment. Because obviously we're in lockdown. But you know, there are lots of different ways in which we communicate, and there's lots of different things that Liberal Democrats are doing and will continue to do. So, you know, we put out leaflets, we do social media posts, lots of people are doing what's called phone banking. And I was phoning local constituents on Saturday afternoon. I spent a couple of hours just sitting at my laptop ringing local people just to ask how they were doing, were they struggling, were there any issues that I could help them with. And so, you know, making phone calls, putting out leaflets when we're able to, you know, there's lots of different ways in which you can campaign, and there always have been. So we'll have to do the other ones that don't involve knocking on doors.
And Ryan has actually moved on to a question about the allocation of taxpayers' money. So this is something that I think is very hot news at the moment. And he's asked, we have seen questionable allocations of taxpayers' money at local and national level. Do you worry about the lack of transparency over government spending? And do you believe that some reports say that cronyism is rife? Do you believe these?
So obviously these are very, very serious allegations, and we've seen reports coming out. I do think there needs to be much greater transparency. Transparency for me is a sort of fundamental principle of everything I do, which is why I try and come and answer questions on your radio station, and I put out a lot of stuff on social media. But I think we do need far more transparency from government. The allegations that have been made are incredibly serious. And we're talking about enormous sums of taxpayers' money, allegedly being allocated to companies that are run by people who are friends with or connected with, you know, ministers and party donors, as opposed to companies that have been selected through an open, transparent procurement process. And so the allegations are very serious, and we need to see some transparency around that so we can actually see whether they are substantiated or not. I am very concerned. I hope that Parliament will get a chance to debate these things soon. I know that there are some MPs trying to get a debate as early as next week. I've had various people contact me locally about various concerns because they're involved in companies that were trying to bid for certain things, and they couldn't get any feedback from government. Of course, there was we're still in the pandemic, but at the start of the pandemic, the government had to move quickly. But it is entirely possible to move quickly and perhaps have a reduced process while still making sure that it is run independently and objectively and based on fair criteria. And I think it's deeply concerning that people are saying that that wasn't the case. So it's not really a case of belief. These are serious allegations where we need to see all the evidence. If I could be Prime Minister for one day, I guess one of the things that I might want to try and introduce, and I feel very strongly about this actually, is a lot more transparency around government procurement. There are other countries around the world where they have a completely open register that identifies and lists every single business, company and charity that receives money from the government, and it's indexed so you can see how many contracts they have, and what the value of those contracts are, and what the purposes of those contracts are as well. I think it's time is ripe to have that kind of level of transparency in terms of how taxpayers' money is used, not least because the government is handing out enormous sums at a time when we're going to be heading into a recession, and every single penny of taxpayers' money needs to be looked after right now.
Now, we moving on to maybe a lighter issue here. It depends if you enjoy cooking that much, but quite a few people have actually seen, obviously, your transparency on social media, that you've been cooking through this lockdown and trying some recipes. So quite a few people have asked, what recipes have you been trying? And a few more people have asked, are there going to be any more recipes that you're going to be cooking, Daisy?
So, do you know what? I do quite like cooking, but my husband loves cooking. So the division of responsibility in the house is that he tends to do most of the cooking, and I'm the sous chef. So if I'm lucky, I'll get to sort of peel and chop some carrots, and then I'll put them in the pan when I'm told to. So I know my place. He does often come and say, well, what should we cook tonight, kind of thing. So my favourite recipes, I think at this time of year, I love a big stew or a big casserole, something that's really, really warming, with potatoes and veg or some rice or something. But I do love a really big dish of, stew or something like that. So what we had recently, we had we had coq au vin on my birthday. That was really nice. We do quite a lot of pasta, arrabbiata type dishes. What else have we had recently? Oh goodness, I didn't know. I'm just trying to think. We've had quite a lot of chicken dishes recently, actually. Yeah, some chicken stews and things like that. Some nice chicken thighs. I'll try to think of some other recipes before the next time I chat to you.
I mean, it all sounds delicious here. You got my mouth watering and everything. And it's amazing. But also, we're coming up to a time where there's going to be a hell of a lot of cooking. And that is going to be Christmas time. And one of the last questions that I wanted to ask in, and maybe open out a little bit more, is you're backing the campaign to shop local in St. Albans this Christmas. And I know the big day is a little while away. Maybe some parents are even fraught and worried, you know, being able to cope with it all, which is fair enough because it is always a kind of worrying thing. But with this pandemic, with coronavirus, it's going to be even harder this year. But what is, you know, some things that you've been particularly drawn to? What might be on the Christmas list for Daisy for this Christmas?
Oh, goodness me. On the Christmas list, what do you mean? The things that I actually want for Christmas or Christmas wishes, do you mean? Christmas wishes.
We could go with both because, I mean, looking at the St. Albans area, there's a lot to offer. So maybe physical on the Christmas list, but also a wish for the area as well, you know, do-gooding
okay.
Well,
wishes are easier, I think. I never know what I want for birthday or Christmas presents. So I normally just say a bottle of gin and a pizza or something. So, but in terms of my wishes for the area, goodness, what would I like? These are probably all government policy things. I would really like the government to provide more certainty for our independent retailers by giving a long-term plan as to how we're going to support our high streets. I think there are, we have no idea what restrictions will or won't be in place after the 2nd of December. You know, I think all the signs at the moment are that if there is a loosening of restrictions on the 2nd, you know, we're not going to go back to anything resembling normal. And there's still, we're going to have to keep some form of restrictions up until Christmas if we want people to be able to see each other then. So I hope that the government does things to help our small independent businesses. That could be extending business rates relief. It could be, for example, something one of my colleagues is calling for, which is for government to cover the cost of postage for small independent businesses that want to post out things to people's houses if they're, you know, if for people who want to buy things online. I think I saw something online today. One of our local independent shops is promoting an adopt-a-shop ahead of Christmas, where people sort of, you know, adopt a shop that they're going to sort of buy their presents and gifts from. So I think fundamentally, what do I wish for the local area? I would like people to remain vigilant about COVID. You know, even if we are allowed to spend time with loved ones over the Christmas period, it doesn't mean that COVID has gone away. And so we all need to continue behaving as though we have it. And so I hope people remain safe and they remain healthy. I hope that our independent businesses can last and not just last, but, you know, have a chance of being able to thrive at some point, sometime soon. What else do I hope for the area? And I hope, I sincerely hope that once we're through this sort of second wave, that we are able to start a real proper conversation about building back better. You know, there are things, there are silver linings that will come out of this pandemic if we grab the opportunity. We've all enjoyed, you know, walking and cycling, and for some people having more of a work-life balance. And I think it's important that we have a serious conversation, you know, nationally and locally about how we're going to embrace that over the Christmas and into the new year as well.
I do have to thank you for your time today, Daisy. As always, it has been informative for the people of the area. And those of you who didn't have their question answered this time, Daisy will be returning next month. But thank you very much, Daisy.
Pleasure.